Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. I've loved fishing since I was a small boy, and if there's one major regret I have, it's that I didn't discover fly fishing until later in life. It's a wonderful pastime that immerses you in nature and involves a never-ending puzzle of solving the very basic problem. What do I do to get a fish to take my fly? It's also fantastic for your mental health. When I'm fly fishing, and I'm certainly not alone in this feeling, all of the things that trouble me just disappear. I'm also very fortunate to live in a place that not many people realize is a fly fishing mecca, Northern California. Our guest this week grew up here and has traveled all over the world to fly fish in some of the planet's most beautiful places, like Alaska and Patagonia. Mike Mercer is one of my fly fishing heroes. He's been an important employee at the fly shop in Redding, California since the 1980s, where he works today helping anglers plan and execute their dream vacations all over the world. Mercer is one of the finest fly tiers on the planet, and his best-selling book, Creative Fly Tying, has guided countless fly tiers from newbies to veterans, featuring some of Mike's most famous patterns. Recently, Mercer was inducted into the Northern California Council's Fly Fishing Hall of Fame. He's a wonderful ambassador for fly fishing. He demystifies what can seem like an intimidating pastime, and he creates a culture of inclusivity around him. Mike will join us in just a bit to tell us about his life standing in beautiful rivers catching wild fish. But first, our guest is Brian Quick. Brian is the director of outfitters at the Fly Shop in Redding, California, and a longtime friend and colleague of Mike Mercer's. He joins us now to give us a bit of insight into his pal. Brian Quick, welcome to Blue Dot.
Yeah, thank you. Great to be on again, Dave.
Well, just like Mike Mercer, I hold you in very high esteem as a person who's got just an incredible background in fly fishing. So you're his peer. Tell us a bit about him from your perspective. When did you first meet Mike Mercer?
I believe the first time I met Mike was probably when they moved the shop down here to Churn Creek from when it used to be up at the place on where Mike's Pizza is now. And I believe he helped me select a fly rod right around the year 2000. I was still in the Air Force and was coming up here when I had some leave to fish with a friend of mine on the Upper Sac.
And you work with him now, your colleagues. What's he like to work with as a friend and angler? And what's he like on the water?
Yeah, so I've taken Mike fishing a few times in my boat on the Sac, and he is a demon. He definitely fishes 100%. And it was actually a lot of fun to have him on the boat because he has several different approaches that kind of differ from a lot of the stuff the guys are doing now. But in the shop, he is 100% focused on making sure that all of his clients are taken care of. And he gets with a lot of clubs and helps new anglers out. He's taken them fishing on several of the different local creeks. I know he took April Brown up to Mount Lassen so he can fish the headwaters of Hack Creek up in the park. So he's very generous with a lot of the local anglers. And he also did a intro to fishing one of the creeks here, which shall remain unnamed due to we want to blow it up. But he's...
Oh, I know which one you're talking about. It's called the Famous River in the Famous Place. Right.
Yeah. So anyway, but he definitely will talk, fly tying and stuff. He's always willing to look at my bugs that I tie up and has good things to say about them, no matter what they look like. So,
well, in knowing him and all this time of going out on the water with him, is there any what are the qualities that he has, you think, that got him into the Fly Fishing Hall of Fame here in California?
Well, I think that if you look at all of his patterns, he looks at tying flies. I think first of giving an impression to the fish that they might see the bugs that are around him, and then comes up with a pattern in that manner rather than looking at a photograph of a bug and tying something that looks, exactly like it. And I think that has definitely opened up a lot of different avenues for other people to explore ways to put flies together that catch fish based on making impressions than anything else. Like if you look at a scud or the missing link, those flies are super good and they work in a variety of situations and they're not like anything else you've ever seen. So,
yeah, when you mentioned that, I thought of impressionism with painting and and music, the impressionistic movement. That's interesting that you described it that way.
Yeah, and when you look at the missing link, I've used it on the San Juan to fool trout that were eating carpenter ants during an ant fall. And it was just the right size, and the wings that represent a dead or dying caddis on the water just happened to replicate the carpenter ant's wings just perfectly. And when everyone else was watching and making casts, I was catching fish. So it just kind of goes to show that his patterns can work in a variety of situations. But I think having those wings that move around quite a bit is definitely a game changer. And so he's had a lot of other patterns, like all his poxy bags. He incorporates a lot of movement. And I think that kind of brings the flies to life. And that's what makes the fish want to eat them so much.
Brian Quick from the Fly Shop, thank you for sharing your relationship with Mike Mercer as we kind of profile him and his induction into the California Fly Fishing Hall of Fame. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, Dave and Matt. Always enjoy being on your show.
Thanks to our guest, Brian Quick from the Fly Shop in Redding, California. Now let's get to the man of our hour, Mike Mercer. Mike, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'd like to know a little bit about your origin story. Tell us about, you know, where you grew up and when you first discovered your love of fishing and, you know, when you started actually fly fishing, when did that start for you?
Well, you know, I grew up just in a farming community outside of Chico, California, just in the valley. And so there really wasn't a lot of water there to, you know, instigate any real interest in fishing or anything. But when I was about 5 or 6 years old, we used to drive up the mountains, and long story, but we'd camp for a month or so at a time up on Hat Creek. And again, I was just a little kid, but my parents bought me a little Snoopy outfit and some salmon eggs. And I'd go down there behind our campsite and fish, and I'd catch trout, these little stock fish that the fishing game would put in there. And somewhere along the way, that just captured my little kid.
Little kid imagination.
Exactly. My imagination and just everything about water just fascinated me. I would be in the up to my knees turning over rocks and looking at the bugs and salamanders and stuff. And, you know, just life in the water in general just fascinated me. And so fast forward quite a few years, and I was probably 10 years old or so when we moved into a new house, and it was near a little creek. And so I had my own built-in fishery, and I was still spin fishing and fishing bait, that sort of thing. And doing really loving it. I'd literally go there every day in the summer and fish all day, every day. And so I was really hooked. And then when I was 12, a guy by the name of John Andrews, he'd just come from the war, and he was trying to do something to kind of reacclimate.
Which war, Mike?
Oh, Vietnam War.
Okay.
And he was trying to reacclimate. So he said, well, I'll teach some kids. Yeah, I'll teach a YMCA class, and we'll do soccer and baseball and stuff like that. And his name was John Andrews, and he loved to fly fish. And so eventually, after all the normal sports, he said, you guys want to try fly fishing? And so a couple of us said, yeah. And one thing led to another, and pretty soon I was fly fishing, had my own outfit, and he took us on fly fishing little journeys, and we'd fish and camp. And it was really, really a cool time of my life, and I recognized, oh, the first time I cast into that little creek by my house with a fly I'd tied and caught about an 8-inch smallmouth bass, I watched it swim over and eat my fly, was like, no more night crawlers. This is all I want to do. And so that's how I started. And it's kind of cool. John and I are still friends. He lives in Idaho, but we still, you know, talk a lot. And he was a great influence in my young fly fishing career.
And when did you start, you know, you talked about tying that first fly or those flies. When did you start that? When did he teach you to do that?
Well, you know, it's not so much. You know, he kind of got us fly fishing, switching from bait fishing to fly fishing. But I started working for a guy named Walton Powell there in Chico where I was. And he was a pretty well-known rod builder. And I wasn't building rods. I was basically just sweeping up and cleaning things up. And his wife, Erlene, was a renowned fly tyer. And she kind of started talking to me about fly tying and teaching me. So Erlene had played a pivotal role in getting me really started in fly tying. And then I started looking at books in the library and kind of self-taught myself to some extent after that. And at that time, Polly Rosborough was kind of famous. He was tying his fuzzy nymphs, they called him. So I tied this little casual dress and a muskrat nymph. And And I, that's the first the fly I really tied. And I went down and fished it in Chico Creek and I watched this bass come over and eat it. And like I said, that moment changed my life. And so from there on, I just started kind of tying on my own a lot, just trying different things. You know, and I found that I had a real interest that kind of came from my early life about, you know, those bugs I saw in the water. And I wanted to say, okay, how, you know, I'm not really always necessarily satisfied with the bugs, the flies that are out there. So I want to kind of try to do some of my own stuff. And so that kind of sent me down a path of creative fly tying.
And so you would actually go out and look at the bugs in your creek and, you know, see if you could kind of make something that looked like that.
Exactly. And that's still what I do. That, you know, that still really fascinates me. And behind all my fly tying is really the thought of what do the fish see and how do they interact with that? What triggers them to eat a fly? You find things out. I found that sometimes you can tie the most realistic looking fly in a world. It looks just like the bug, almost indistinguishable from the real thing. And they spurn it. It's like, nah, I'm not eating that thing. So you start realizing, okay, that's not necessarily the key. So what is it? Is it profile? Is it color? Is it the way it moves in the water? So just like, what does the fish see and what is it that triggers him to eat? And so there's a lot of trial and error involved with that. And a lot of just trying to figure that out and just figuring out, get inside that little fish's head and see what it is. And so for me, that's a great challenge. I love that. And there's a lot of flies I come up with that are not good. The fish do not like them. And so I'm just kind of keep working on them. And sometimes I tie by attrition. You know, I'll tie this fly with 20 steps. I think this is perfect. And it's like, that. Nope, they don't like it. Or they do like it. And if they really do like it, it's like 20 steps, that's too many. So I'll start taking steps away and say, okay, does it still work? And if it does, then okay, that's now we're at 19. Let's be easier to tie. And we kind of go from there. And so if I can get it down less steps and still just as effective as the fish, I love that. But I also am not afraid of having a lot of steps in a fly because I just feel like the more triggering features I can build into a fly, the more likely it is that they're going to take that fly.
Well, fly fishing in general, it's a passion for me. It's something that I unfortunately discovered later in life. I wished I had discovered it much younger. Although, like you, when I was a little kid, I remember a little Zebco push button cast rod. You know, it's just a little thing in Bishop, California, on our family's dude ranch pond, and catching my first rainbow trout and looking at that, thinking that is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. And that's what hooked me on fishing. But for many years, I viewed fly fishing as something for rich people. It was kind of seemed out of my realm, elitist maybe. But for a lot of people all over the world, you included, it's what you love to do. And I know this is a hard question because I have a hard time answering it to people to try to explain. You know, when they say, oh, you like to fish. And I go, yeah, but fly fishing. It's like, well, yeah, that's just fishing, right? Well, yeah, it is, but there's more to it. I don't know. What is it about fly fishing that's so alluring and consuming to people like you and me?
You know, I think the fly fishing as opposed to like spin fishing, fishing with bait and that sort of thing, I don't necessarily agree with some people think, well, it's more effective than bait fishing or that sort of thing. It's like, nah, not necessarily. A really good bait fisherman is going to be deadly. I think that for fly fishing, there's more facets perhaps than a lot of different kinds of fishing. You have different kinds of water you find different species in. They're going to eat different foods, so you have to get to recognize that and try to emulate those foods. You're often in beautiful places when you fly fish, so wading a pretty stream, that sort of thing. And there's just a lot of facets involved, which you can take as few or as many as you want. Some people are just going to want to have one or two flies that they love to fish, they have confidence in, and go fish all kinds of water with those two flies. And inevitably, they do pretty well because they become good anglers. The other people want to get into entomology. They want to understand different kinds of techniques. They'll want to understand where fish lie in different kinds of water. There's so many different ways you can approach the sports and involve yourself, probably more than most kinds of fishing, I think. And again, different styles of water. Now you can look at bass fishing, you have a lot of stuff going on there too, different lures and to some extent different kinds of water. But for the most part, you're more looking at similar water types and approaching the bass with different kinds of lures, you know, in conventional fishing. Whereas with fly fishing, you know, you can just do so many more different things, emulate different styles of food, tiny little bugs to large bait fish. And two, I this is maybe going on a limb a little bit, but I find that a lot of people, fly fishing kind of allows one to become immersed in their environment. And it does for me anyway. I know a lot of people are like that. You go out and you put on your gear and you get your fly rods, you put on your hip pack or whatever it is, and you go out and you wade into a stream. And for me, a lot of times, just like everything else goes away at that point. And I'm just immersed in this river. I'm looking for a trout rising. I'm looking for a good piece of water where a trout might lie. I'm thinking about what they might be eating, looking for bugs on top of the water, and just total immersion. And everything goes away. So if I've had a stressful day, got something going on at work or whatever, it just goes away like magic, like no drug can do. You're still healthy and feeling good, and you're just, everything fades.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with legendary fly angler and fly tyer, Mike Mercer. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with Mike Mercer. Mike is a world-renowned fly tyer and fly fisher who has worked at the fly shop in Redding, California for decades. Recently, Mike was inducted into the Northern California Fly Fishing Hall of Fame. Fly fishing, you know, though it can seem mystifying, and like I said, a bit elitist if you at first. That was the thing that I remember my breakthrough was when I figured out, it's like, oh, I can do this and it's not that expensive and I can have fun and this is not that complicated. So I'm wondering if maybe we can help break down the basics. Maybe somebody listening, you know, has a kid or somebody, you know, their husband or wife that wants to maybe try this. Maybe break down the basics. What would someone just need to just to get off to a solid start without, you know, you go into a fly shop and it can be kind of overwhelming. But what are the basics that you need?
Yeah, it's a good question. And really, I mean, start out with basics. You need a fly rod, a fly reel, and a fly line, some leaders, flies, maybe some fly floating to make your dry flies float, some nippers to cut your monofilament leader. And that's kind of about it. It's not that much. And it can be pretty simplistic. And sometimes with all the gear I have, I prefer to kind of ratchet back and fish very simply. I mean, you have things like Tenkara, which is just a telescoping rod and some leader off the end. That's it. But more typically for a fly fishing outfit, you start with a rod, reel, line. And, you know, you can get a pretty reasonable outfit. People do tend to think about fly fishing, oh, that's so expensive. It's so elitist. Like, I could never do that. And you can get a really fine rod, reel, line outfit for around $300. You know, I'm speaking about things we have here at the fly shop, but other places have that too, for sure. And the one thing I always tell people is when you get started, you want to go to make that initial purchase, the rod, reel, line. The most important part of that purchase is always going to be the fly line. It's almost always going to be a floating fly line because that's the most versatile. But people say, come on, a fly line is more important than the rod? That doesn't make any sense. And a lot of times if you come from like a spin fishing background, it doesn't. I mean, monofilament's cheap, right? And a rod is really important. It has to be right to throw the lures and bait and stuff. But in fly fishing, you could go down to get the cheapest fly rod in the world and buy a good top-end fly line, and you're going to be able to do okay. That line will cast, the rod will flex, and the fly line will throw itself out there. Conversely, you could come in here at the fly shop and buy a $1,400 fly rod, go get the cheap fly line, and it's not going to work. That cheap fly line is not going to slide through the guides. It's the weight of the line is not going to work with the rod. And so it really is important for people just getting started to know that fly line's key. The rod's important for sure, typically the reel is not as important. For most people, the reel is going to hold the line and let it off smoothly if you catch a big enough fish. But it's just usually, unless you're catching really big fish in salt water or in big rivers, the reel is the least important. So after that, if you're fishing cold water, you know, you may need waders. So get a pair of waders and shoes. You can, you know, get those relatively inexpensively anymore, to a pair of breathable waders and a pair of boots that have felt on the bottom or studs that will help you from slipping on the bottom, that sort of thing. But it's really about it. You know, some flies, some leaders.
And I would add that if somebody's getting into it, summertime is the best time to get into it, because you can get away without waders in the summer. Most places I go, like right now, I don't need waders in the summertime. And, you know, that can be kind of a barrier to people going, oh God, I got to get waders. You can just start out with a very basic outfit. Like you said, don't skimp on the line, get yourself a decent rod and good line and, you know, and a few flies and away you go. The next thing I would ask, and that, you know, just from my own experiences, you got to learn how to use that rod. And, it's really good if you can get together with somebody like a club or, you know, somebody that is experienced like you, and just get some basics on how to cast that fly rod.
Absolutely. And, you know, and there's a wealth of things online anymore to use that you can use, and you can teach yourself a lot. What you say is true, though. If you can have a live living person next to you saying, oh, try this. You know, and it's kind of help you not start with bad casting habits. It's very important. It's super helpful. But you can teach yourself online. There's enough things out there that do a good job of teaching. You can do it. Fly clubs are a great resource. I mean, a lot of places have fly clubs, and they almost always have interactive service. You have people that'll spend some time on the lawn with you and cast and do clinics. And you have fly shops. Like, I work at the fly shop, and if you are just getting into it and you have an outfit and you just come in and say, man, can you give me like just a couple minutes just to kind of give me a hint on my casting, watch my casting and see what I'm doing wrong, or just give me a few tidbits. I mean, we're happy to do that. It just takes a few minutes, and then you can take that knowledge and go back to your own yard and work on it. And so there's a fair amount of different ways you can learn to cast. And it is a big deal that people, I think, sometimes make too big of a deal of how difficult it is to learn to cast. Personally, I think it's not too much more difficult to learn to fly cast than it is spin cast. There's a lot of manual dexterity really demanded of both. With the spinning rod, you've got to hold the line in your finger, have to cast, let go of the line just the right millisecond. I mean, there's a lot to that, doing that well. And fly fishing is not that much difference. It's just, of course, in fly fishing, the weight of the line is delivering your fly or your lure. And spin fishing is the weight of the lure that's delivering itself. So there's a different concept, but the fly casting is not really all that tough. It's not unusual for me to take out an absolute new beginner who's never fly fished before, and in a couple hours they're catching fish. And very often my kind of mode on that is to teach them basic casting so they can do, you know, pick up and lay down, can cast 20, 30 feet, but they learn about how to deliver a fly. And for success, that's really more important than casting. You have to know some very basic things to cast. But a lot of these people I bring out, they could only cast about 15, 20 feet. And then
a lot of time, that's all you need.
Exactly. A lot of times all you need. And then you can learn how to develop to deliver the fly, a feeding line out through the rod or whatever it is, and then become successful. So if you can deliver the fly in such a way that the fish will eat it, that's really in some ways more important than casting. Now, certainly casting can become much more important as you branch out and fish bigger rivers and need to cast farther. And but I always do tell people, don't get too overwhelmed by needing to cast 50 feet, 60 feet well before you go fishing. It's not really necessary.
Yeah, rarely do I have to do that.
You're right.
Very rare. So, yeah, that's a barrier that really is pretty easily tackled. I think one of the most fun things to me, it was like when I first got started, I knew nothing about the bugs, really nothing. You know, it's like, I think, and my first fly was a woolly bugger. And I don't think that even represents any certain type of bug. It's just a thing, yeah. But it, you know, it does catch fish. But then it was like, you know, I would be around these guys that were seasoned fly anglers, and they'd be saying things like, well, there's a Calabatus hatch up on Manzanita Lake. You know, it's like they're speaking a different language. Yeah. I don't know what they're talking about. I have no idea what that means. You know, it's, and that can seem really overwhelming and intimidating. But it's fun once you start to learn, and it's not that hard. You don't need to learn all the names of the Latin names of the bugs. You just need to know some basics. And what I like about it is you're using the scientific method. You're making observations and you're going, oh, I see bugs over there flying around the water. You know, what are they doing? How big are they? What color are they? Could you talk a bit about just, you know, learning the bugs?
Well, absolutely. It's one of those things that for me is really enjoyable. I love that part of it. Again, it's the life that's underwater that we don't see. It's a whole different world. And inevitably, when I'm teaching people, teacher will go out and we'll practice casting and look at flies and leaders and stuff. And I'll say, well, let's do a little entomology lesson. I'll take a little mesh out and roll some rocks around and catch some bugs in the current and show them. And normally their eyes get big, especially kids, but adults too. It's like, what? That stuff lives down there? And they just had no idea what's underwater. And it can be little tiny insects, can be big sculpins, big bait fish. It can be all kinds of things in between. And again, it's like, what are the fish seeing down there? And so they get a real idea of one of the fun parts of fly fishing is understanding there's this whole other world down there. And once we know a little bit about that, we can do a better job of choosing our flies and be more successful. You don't have to. You can choose a half dozen different flies and do pretty well in most places most of the time, honestly. But by learning what's under the water, it's fun to do. And as you said, it's not necessary to know all the names. You can just identify them visually. That's fine. If it interests you and you want to learn what they are and their Latin names and everything, that's awesome. It's good. But it is no way necessary. You can just say, that's a mayfly. That's a caddis. That's a stonefly. That's a midge. Those four categories pretty much covers it. And there's different sizes and colors in those four categories. But you can just look and you can say, okay, I remember mayflies, the floating adult, that's got a little sailboat wing, or the caddis, it's got little tent-shaped wings. But then past that, you just say, okay, they're eating a caddis, but it's a size 14 and it's green. And so you look in your box, what do I got that's pretty close to that? In fact, fish aren't always quite as discerning as we give them credit for. And as long as you've got the right size of fly and the right basic profile, they'll usually eat it. But it can be, if you get a difficult fish that's kind of snubbing you on your favorite fly, you got to look a little closer. It's like, okay, what's he actually eating? Maybe it's not what I think. And watch that fish rise a few times. Or if you see him under the water feeding and kind of glinting, it's like, oh, he's nymphing down there. He's eating some bug underneath the water. What is it? And sometimes I'll wade in, you know, well away from the fish, obviously, and do a little seine netting and see, oh, there's a whole bunch of this certain kind of bug. There's a whole bunch of this number 14 mayfly nymphs floating down. So again, it can be pretty straightforward.
And when you say number 14, you're referring to the size of the fly. And like in a lot of things in fly fishing, the numbering seems like kind of screwed up.
yes.
So like with the size of the fly, like 14 is bigger than 16. And 18 is smaller, and then 20 is really tiny. And once it gets smaller than that, it's like, forget it, I can't see that. But yeah, that's kind of an interesting aspect of it. I would say, just based on what I've learned, and I know so much less than you do, that, you know, the most important thing is match the size. You know, just yeah. try to get the size of what they're eating. If they're eating some little teeny things and you got some big thing on there, probably not going to work.
I agree completely. Yeah, no, that's the first and most important thing. Get the size correct. It's something that's not going to stand out to them as being something false or, you know, not food. If it's the same size and hopefully it's relatively the same profile, they're probably going to eat it, especially if it's in faster moving water where they don't have a lot of time to make a decision. If it's in really slow moving water, then you've got to be a little more accurate. But in fast water, they get a knee jerk. They've got to make a decision now. Sometimes if you kill a fish to eat and you just cut him open, he's got rocks and sticks and stuff in his guts. It's like they make the wrong decision quite a bit. And so, you know, you've got pretty good odds in faster water.
And okay, let's go back to fly tying, because you're very famous as a fly tier. And you kind of told us how you got started. What is the allure of fly tying? Because I think for somebody who doesn't do it, looking at that, you're going, it's like, well, it seems kind of tedious and boring. Why would somebody really love that? But you obviously, and a lot of people do. What is it about tying flies that you really like?
Well, you know, I think sometimes it comes in stages or seasons. When I first started tying, I was just really enthralled with it, the process. I'm not an artist, but that allowed me to create and be kind of an artist in a way. And I love that. And then after that, after a while, it allowed me to, you know, just produce flies for myself to tie, so I didn't have to buy them. And after a while, I started tying commercially. So I'd sell my tie flies and sell them. So it allowed me to have extra pocket change. And then eventually that commercial period kind of soured me on big numbers of flies. You know, I'd stay up all night tying 20 dozen of the same thing. And I really never wanted to ever have to do that again in the rest of my life.
Oh, yeah, but that would burn you out.
Oh, it'd be burnout. But I mean, but it did teach me a lot of things. And eventually I got to the place where, although I never want to have to tie more than one or two of the same patterns, what I really want to do, what really kind of spins my wheels, is trying to come up with a new fly, be creative. And I guess in my mind, there's always the thought, there's a perfect fly out there if I can just figure it out. And so I like just trying new things. You know, fly tying for the most part tends to be, even creative tying, tends to be borrowing another's ideas and putting those ideas together in a new way. And maybe once in a while you do have something truly brand new that you can interject into the puzzle and figure things out. But I just love that thinking about, okay, what are they eating? What can I do that's going to create this irresistible impulse in this fish to eat my fly? So I like to try new stuff. And so I love tying now, but I rarely tie for more than an hour now. It used to be, you know, hours on end. Now I just have thoughts in my mind, or I've been out in the stream fishing and I saw a certain reaction from a trout to a certain kind of a bug. I thought, whoo, I wonder if I can imitate that, because that fish obviously liked that. And it'll come back to my vise, look at all my materials, try to think outside the box, materials I might normally just kind of think, oh, it's kind of that material is only good for this kind of fly or that kind of fly. I think, nope, I'm going to try to use this material over here in a way no one's ever used. Seems stupid, but I'm going to try it, you know? And that's, so for me, that creative process is where I'm at now.
Well, that definitely is an art form. And you're a very famous fly tier now. Lots of patterns are called Mercers. my personal favorite is the Mercer's Missing Link dry fly.
Thank you.
Personal favorite fly. And it's just, it's cool looking fly. But I'm really curious about you. There are so many patterns that, you know, if you were, like I told the audience about the Woolly Bugger, that's an ancient, you know, people have been using that for a long time. Yep. And there's all kinds of patterns that have been around, you know, like the Adams and things like that have been around for, literally centuries. But, you know, to get your name attached to something, it means something very special, like, you know, a Mercer's Missing Link, or, you know, Kelly Gallup is a famous tier of streamers. And some of his flies have very suggestive names, shall we say, you know, the Sex Dungeon and things like that.
Kelly's the character.
Yeah. But so I wonder about the process of that, though, you know, because to go from, okay, you're at your vise, you saw something during the day, you saw this trout behavior, you decided to go and create something new, and then you find that it works. And then how do you go from that to, okay, all over North America in fly shops, hither and yon, you know, you look in bins and you see a Mercer's whatever. How does that work where you, because you don't tie all those, certainly.
No, I don't. No, it's interesting because, you know, go back, well, like almost 50 years ago when the fly shop started, and that's when I started here when it first opened up.
When was that?
That was 1978. And back in those days, there wasn't much of a way of what we call commercial tires, where big, you know, operations would tie flies and then fly shops could buy from them. That was almost a new concept back then. There was a little bit of that, but mostly the flies, we either tied them ourselves or we had local tires that tied them, or at least in country, in individual tires in the United States that tied flies. And probably 40 years or so ago, there was a place called Umpqua Feather Merchants, and the owner had an idea. He said, you know, why don't I start fly tying and do it on a grander scale than it's been done before. And his thought was, because he was used to being overseas and in parts of Asia and that sort of thing, I can take the ideas of fly tires today and recreate them overseas in factories, you know, and not, these aren't sweatshops. These are places where traditionally ladies tie them and are great conditions. They're superb craftspeople. They do a great job. And his idea was, and then I can supply the fly shops with greater numbers than they ever been able to before. Because again, traditionally years ago, it was always hard to get enough flies and the ones you needed, even though back then there were so fewer flies, it was very basic. But even then, it was hard to keep the fly bins filled. And a lot of it we had to do ourselves. And so he took this concept and what he called like a royalty concept. So he would sign on individual fly tires. And back then, there was probably only like a dozen of us because it was pretty early on in fly fishing, you know, in the fly shops and stuff. And said, okay, what is it? You're going to teach me how to tie these flies exactly the way you want them. I'll bring them to my factories in Sri Lanka and the different places where I have these factories set up. We're going to recreate them exactly the way you want them, and then we'll sell them to you. And then Mike, you know, you'll get a little royalty off the flies. And then the fly shop will have all the flies they need, top quality. And so it was a unique concept back then. Now it's just how things are done. Not always the royalty program. Sometimes some places just buy flies. And so I just got signed up on that program, you know, all those years ago. And so still going on, I'm still creating flies. They're still taking my flies and recreating them and selling to fly shops all over the world. And flies come and go. You know, there's some of my flies that are great for, you know, they sell well for a while and then they'll kind of fade off. And one thing you mentioned, which is really true, is that there's a few flies that have been around for decades, if not, you know, 100 or more years. And those flies, they have stood the test of time. They've never really faded away, which is remarkable. Because some of my flies, I mean, that I came up with 45, 50, almost 50 years ago, they're still in production, still being sold. But they're not in the same category as the flies you mentioned, like the Adams and some of those traditional classic dry flies. So mine is funny. I've noticed they go away, they lose popularity, and then in 10 years or 15 years, they come back. And the woolly worm's another example. Your first fish you caught a woolly worm, I don't know what it imitates. It's kind of a generic looking thing.
Could but be it a fell fish, could be a bug, yeah, could be anything. Exactly. It could be trout just like it.
Yeah,
and bass.
It fell out of popularity, and people go, woolly worm, I mean, he's a woolly worm, that's a stupid fly. And then lo and behold, you know, 20 years later, people are using woolly worms again. And so it's interesting.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue to explore the art and science of fly fishing with one of its legendary practitioners, Mike Mercer. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with Northern California Fly Fishing Hall of Famer Mike Mercer about the art, science, and passion he shares with fly anglers all over the world. I've had some experience with grief lately, loss, and I know that fly fishing was a way out for me.
Yep.
It kept me from going down the mental toilet, as it
yep.
were.
Exactly.
It has these tremendous mental health benefits. There's something about, as John Gearock, the author, said, something about standing in a river waving a stick that is just really good for your mind.
Yeah.
You know, and there's examples of this. There's Project Healing Waters, the veterans groups like that, that get together with veterans that have terrible PTSD and get them into the outdoors. And a lot of them, you know, grew up loving to go fishing and hunting and, you know, just being in the outdoors. Connect them back to that little boy. Get them into tying their own flies, learning to fly cast, you know, just learning this thing, and then get them out there in that immersive experience. And that it has been proven to have wonderful benefits for them. You know, you just hear them rave about how good they feel and the camaraderie of being with each other because they're all, you know, veterans. And there's the movie that came out recently, Mending the Line, that's on Netflix, which is, you know, is an account of this kind of thing, where a guy comes back from, it's either Iraq or Afghanistan. And, you know, he goes through some real bad trauma, gets spiraling down into drugs and alcohol, and he's really, you know, lost. And it's hooking up with a veteran, that, you know, from the Vietnam War era, who also has issues, that, you know, gets him out of it through the world of fly fishing. What are your thoughts on that? You know, on what you've observed over the years, and for yourself personally, that how fly fishing is this just wonderful mental health activity.
Yeah, no, it really is. That's for sure. And I think it's unusually enough, there's two kind of divergent things that it offers. One of which is this kind of wonderful immersion, almost isolated experience where we can kind of forget everything that's going on and just immerse ourselves and totally concentrate on what we're doing and just kind of escapism. And there's also the community part of it. And I think there's a lot of the, like the Project Healing Waters and those kind of programs, you know, they're bringing community around people who don't have community, who don't think they need it, or they don't want it, or they don't know what it looks like. They don't know if it's possible. And so you have this soft community that comes around and this shared love of fishing. And so they go out and you may not even always fish right together, you know, but they may help a person learn to fish and learn some of the basics of it, and then let them have some of their own space, you know, and do it. Fly fishing, not always thought about as a community kind of a thing, but it is a wonderful, small, tight community, the fly fishing culture itself. And so it's neat to be able to spend time with people talking about fly fishing with them, you know, just experiencing it together to in some extent, that, you know, but it's also something where you can take that community support and then go do it on your own and enjoy it still with that community in your heart. And just still knows, you know, there's this community out there that loves the same thing you do. And it kind of, it's almost like
you're part of something bigger than yourself.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That is a part of it for sure. But it offers both, which is kind of unusual. You often it's one thing or the other. You just have a sport that you lose yourself in, and you know, it's no one else involved. It's just, that's your escapism, or it's something you do with someone else, you know, pickleball or tennis or basketball, or, you know, go to the bar and drink or whatever it is. But this has kind of both. And I've always really liked that, because you can kind of choose. I'm going to fish by myself. I feel like being by myself today. I'm going to go out and enjoy the water in a way that I probably can't when I'm with someone else. And other days it's like, I don't want to be by myself today. I want to go out and enjoy the experience together and share it with someone else. And we'll laugh and, you know, compare notes. And, you know, afterwards we'll go have a meal and talk about the day. And it's just, there's a time for both.
Yeah, and once you get past the, oh, you know, I have to catch as many fish as you do kind of thing, it really is fun when you have a friend fishing, especially if maybe there's somebody that's less experienced than you are, and there's a real joy in watching them be successful.
Oh, there really is. That probably, honestly, Dave, I think one of the most enjoyable things for me at this point in my life is bringing new fishermen out. Someone who really, you can tell, has the desire, they want to do it. Recently I had a couple young women that I knew one for years, and she had a friend I've never met. And she says, I know, I love to fish. I want to learn how to fly fish. And she's probably, you know, in her 30s or so. She's not, you know, young or old. She's in kind of early midlife. And she just really had this urge, you know, really want to, I've seen it done. I really want to know what it's about. And so we took her out and she had a fantastic day. I mean, she would have had a fantastic day if I'd not done anything. She just was so excited to be out there and handling the fly rod and seeing how it's done and being in the water. So for me, and I do that all the time, and I love that. Like, as you said, it gives you so much satisfaction and joy to see someone who really has a zeal, for really wants to do it, out there, and just give them some techniques, give them some points. And they usually suck it up like a sponge and they just want it so much. And then they can get to the point where they can do it themselves. But that is so satisfying to watch that process. Cause I remember myself when I was a kid, but I mean, I just lived and breathed. That's all I wanted to do. And consequently, that's pretty much all I did for a lot of my life, one way or another, but it is really cool to watch that process.
You have an interesting job at the fly shop where you are involved in travel. in sending people, you know, off, whether it be in North America or right here in Northern California, where there's some pretty darn good fishing in Northern California within a couple hours of my house. I know
there is.
But could you talk a bit about, you know, how you got into that and what some of the parts of that you enjoy about, you know, getting somebody set up on a trip to go somewhere and, you know, and then to hear back from them what the experience was like?
Absolutely. So what I'm basically a fly fishing travel agent. I didn't start that position here, but probably 20 years or so ago, I segued into that. And so what that means is that there's half dozen of us in one of the offices here at the fly shop, where we take calls and emails all day long with people who want to go on a big fly fishing trip somewhere in the world, or it could be even in the United States. It's, you know, more exotic locations, places where there's lodges or camps, that sort of thing. And so when someone calls me up, they say, "I'm like, I want to go to New Zealand, but I don't know anything about it. Where do I start? I want to go to Alaska. I want to, you name it, anywhere in the world." And each of us here have our own specialties. I mean, I handle most of the people that want to go to Alaska, New Zealand, Patagonia, that sort of thing, a little bit in the Rockies. And other people do more saltwater and, you know, just different places in the world. But they call up and they say, "Okay, I know I want to take this big trip. It's a trip of a lifetime for me. Where do I start? How do I know what's out there? How do I know what's right?" And so I can lead them down the road. I can say, "Okay, so what time of year can you go? Or you know, do you really desire from this trip?" And that's a big one, because I want to set realistic expectations for people. Say they want to go to Alaska. I say, "Okay, you want to go to Alaska? That's great. What do you want to catch?" And, you know, 75% of the time they say, "Yeah, fish." Well, I say, "Okay, that's good."
There's a lot of different kind of fish there.
But in Alaska, we've got 5 different kinds of salmon. We've got rainbow trout. We've got Arctic char. We've got Arctic grayling. We've got sheephish. We've got all these different species, all of which are going to be kind of seasonal to some extent. You know, some are better some months of the year, you know, not as good other times. And so do you want to just go look for giant rainbows? Or do you want to go to a lodge that flies you out and fishes for all kinds of species? You know, what do you want? And sometimes, like, they kind of need help understanding what they want from what's there. And so anyway, it's a process and one I really enjoy, because usually when people call, they're excited. They've determined they're going to take this big trip, and now they just need to know more about how to go about it. And so that's what I do. I've been traveling for 40 years, you know, all over the place. And I know the lodges, I know the countries, I know how to get in and out, I know what all the details are. And so, you know, people need to know, what do my airlines look like? Well, how do I do that? How do I do it? Well, what do I tip? You know, at the end of the week, I need to tip these people. What do I tip them? You know, or what flies am I going to need? What rods, what lines? And so all that, you know, we just are uniquely qualified to set people up for that. And because that's what we do, that's our lives. And we've been doing it for decades. And so it's really a cool place to come sit down in the morning, knowing you're going to have people calling you up that, for the most part, are pretty excited about this phone call. And it's going to be the first call of many that's going to lead them down this road to their dream trip.
You know, another thing that about fly fishing that appeals to me is because I love nature and conservation, and the ethics of being a steward of the environment has always been deeply important to me in my life. And fly fishing is really wrapped up in that. What are some of the, you know, what are your thoughts on fly fishing and environmental ethics? Because there really is a kinship there.
Well, for sure. I mean, they kind of go together. I mean, many years ago, there was a famous fly fisherman by the name of Lee Wolf who first made the observation that, "And these fish, they're too valuable to be caught only once. We have to start releasing these fish, not eating everything." And that's kind of started this ethic of catch and release, which is all totally bound up with fly fishing, and they kind of go together. And so along with that, there's just all kinds of conservation things that happen. Almost all fly fishing clubs in towns where you have guys and girls that gather and go fishing together and share flies and stuff, they usually have like a conservation part of their club too, that just works around preserving local waters or keeping local waters from getting polluted. Or maybe they invest in a faraway river that needs help. And even if it's just, you know, just money to try to help the people live there, save their river, that sort of thing. And so, yeah, you're very right. And there's around here, there's places like California Trout and across the country, Trout Unlimited, and the Northern California Council of Fly Fishers. I mean, there's a number of bigger name places that really do, that's their vision, They fly fish, but for many people, almost more passionate about saving and preserving the fisheries that we do have. And there's so many things that are wrong with some of our rivers. Take, for example, all the dams that have been on the Klamath River for many, many, many years. And, you know, they serve their purpose for electricity and that sort of thing. It's not that they were inherently bad, but unfortunately, one of the side effects of those dams is that it kept anadromous fish, fish that live in the ocean and come into rivers to spawn, from reaching their natal spawning grounds. So suddenly you just decimate these ocean living, river running fish because they can't get to where they need to go to procreate. And so over a period of a few decades, you maybe had 1 million fish coming up a stream. Now you've got 120. And within a few years, there'll be zero. And so conservationists came together, and uniquely in the Klamath watershed, they came together with local native organizations, ventures, you know, all these organizations that typically butted heads and wanted different things. And so they always fought each other. These organizations came together and worked together along with the people who owned and operated the dams to convince them, like, these dams have to go. We have got to get rid of these things. And so it took a long, long time, a lot of years. But finally, they all agreed, and now the dams are gone, and these fish, amazingly, fish that have never seen these parts of the rivers are going to them and spawning, which is, like, how do they know? But Mother Nature just takes care of herself. And, you know, within a month or two of the dams coming out, these salmon that live in the ocean and come inland to spawn, they're going where the dams used to be. They're the only thing they've ever known. They're going past that. They're going up in the mountains to little creeks where they spawn. And it's just like, it's like a miracle. But organizations like this are necessary. And then I think we all need to have some part in them, because it's important, because without them, we're going to lose all of our fisheries. But with them, we can preserve what we have. We can look ahead and try to be a little proactive and not hurt fisheries in the first place. Maybe not build a dam where it's not necessary, that sort of thing. And so, yeah, they're important. And we all should have at least some role in supporting them.
Yeah, those salmon bring those ocean nutrients inland.
They do. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and put them into that watershed. Yeah. Well, we're almost out of time, but before we let you go, you recently had the honor of being inducted into the California Fly Fishing Hall of Fame, and I'm just curious, what did that mean to you?
Well, you know, first it's like, I think they got the wrong guy.
I don't think so.
Because it's like, I was in pretty low profile. I didn't, like, really, me? But honestly, it was gratifying, because it's kind of like being recognized by your peers. And I've been doing this in this fly shop for almost 50 years now. And I've, over those years, I've met so many remarkable people, just amazing individuals that gave so much of their lives to the sport and to the people who are engaged in and interested in it. And just, it's a very giving culture, and the fly shop's just part of that. And so I've been lucky enough to be part of that, and, you know, having been given that gift when I was younger and growing up, and being able to give that gift back as I've got older, and it's really sweet. And so I get to recognize not just myself in that award, but all these other people that have come before me, or they're here right with me now. And just, we can celebrate the fact that it is a beautiful sport. And yeah, I'm in it for business to some extent, but it goes deeper than that. And I just love the people that are in it. It's a super privilege to get that award. And I just can see how many other people are a part of that award. I mean, it sounds cliche, but because it's me, I can see the truth in that. It's like, yeah, no, I've heard that a lot of times, but it's really true. Without all these guys, all these gals, all these people that fed into me and continue to feed into me, I mean, no one would even think about me for this kind of award. And so it's pretty sweet to think back on all the years that I've been rubbing elbows with people, both famous and really well-respected people, and just brand new people to the sport, and everything in between.
Well, it's been a joy to talk to you, Mike Mercer, and about this wonderful sport of fly fishing. And, you know, and anybody interested in it, you know, I encourage them to just go to your local fly shop, wherever that might be, and ask a few questions, and, you know, maybe give it a try. I think you might find that it's a beautiful thing to do.
Thanks, Dave. It's been fun.
Thanks again to our guests from the Fly Shop in Redding, California, Brian Quick and his friend and colleague, Mike Mercer. He was recently named a Northern California Fly Fishing Hall of Famer. You can learn more about the wonders of fly fishing and maybe even book a trip to some amazing destination with the help of Brian and Mike at theflyshop.com. And as you're listening to this, I can tell you right now that Mike Mercer is standing in a river in Yellowstone National Park. Guess what? Fly fishing. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.